Pardon me, everyone. It's the operator, and I just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And, sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Sorry, one sec. Okay. Right, then. So I can see, I suppose, actually, I'll do the roll call from here. I can't see who's on the phone bridge who isn't on Adobe Connect. So I can see Jennifer Standiford, who's the registrar, stakeholder group secretary, who cannot speak because I believe she's suffering from a sore throat or something. I'm here. I can see James Bodell, who's our treasurer. Jeff Eckhouse, I know, is on the line somewhere, but he's not on Adobe Connect. I can also see Chris Crook, Tom Barrett, John Berryhill, Joyce Lynn, Luke Souffert. I have no idea who Michael is.
Michael Ward.
Oh, hi, Michael Ward. Sorry. Mike Murphy, I assume that's cum laude?
That's correct, yep.
Thanks. Sean Wilkie from Lattice, Susan Prosser. I have no idea who T is.
It's me, it's Tom Keller from 101.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Volker, so I can never pronounce that correctly, and Yoav. Is there anybody else on the phone bridge whose name I haven't called out? I'll take that silence to mean no. I'm going to pass this over, I think, towards Tom Barrett, since he's been taking the lead on this. Tom, do you want to kind of talk us through briefly where we're at on this?
Sure, I can do that. This is Tom Barrett. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Right. So, well over a year ago, the registrar constituency decided to put together a working group to take a look at the bylaws of the stakeholder group and to see how they might be changed to take into consideration some of the impacts that new TLDs would have on the stakeholder group. And so four of us got together. We worked through the fall of last year. We did a survey to all the members over the winter. We've discussed this at the last four or five in-person meetings, wherever ICANN's held their meeting. And we've now arrived at a point where some amendments have been proposed. This has been two or three months now. We've had, I think, some good discussions on some of these amendments and quite a few friendly and unfriendly amendments. And so I think we've gotten to a point where we'd like to stop before, I guess, as the proposer of the amendments, I have the right to call for a vote. But before we do that, we want to make sure that everyone has had a chance to provide their comments, provide any suggestions for friendly or unfriendly amendments, and make sure we haven't we've given everyone a fair chance to do that before we start voting on this.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Does anybody have any comments or additions or questions or queries or anything else at this juncture? Wow, silence.
So I'll bring up a question. At the last meeting in Durban...
Sorry, who's speaking?
I'm sorry, this is Tom Barrett again. Some members did mention that there should be a parallel effort to take a look at the mission or charter of the stakeholder group. And the question is that still a need that we should pursue, or has that gone away given some of the friendly amendments to these bylaws? And I guess as a follow-up to that, is there even a mission or to the stakeholder group that could revise if we wanted to?
So anybody have any comments on this? Okay, I'm seeing Jennifer saying on the chat she has no comments on this one. I'm going to be nasty and actually ask people specifically. James, do you have any thoughts? Volker, Luke, anybody?
This is James. No comments on this.
Okay. Does anybody have any other comments? Go ahead, Volker.
I made my comment on the list already, so I all commented out already at this juncture.
So let me ask this, Tom Barrett again. Let me ask you a question. Does everyone feel like they've had a chance to provide comments or amendments to what's been proposed so far?
Tom, this is Michele. Just speaking on my own behalf, I think we have had quite a bit of backwards and forwards on this. So I can't speak for everybody. I mean, personally, I'm happy enough.
Yeah, this is James. I agree. There's been ample opportunities for folks to comment on these. Are we going? And I apologize, guys. I got interrupted there for a moment. Are we going through these numerically? And if so, I assume we're discussing the three bullets at the top, or have we moved on to the summary of the amendments themselves?
Well, we haven't really seen on the document itself. This is Tom. I just want to make sure that before we dove in, if there weren't any high-level issues or concerns people wanted to bring up.
Hey, thanks.
Okay, maybe Tom, at this juncture, maybe we could just kind of walk us through the specifics of this.
Okay.
The specific elements. I'll put myself back on mute.
All right. And I guess the other open question, I know we've asked this in the past, given that there's a staff person on this call, is what the next step would be after we vote on these bylaws, whether staff then needs to get involved and somehow put this out for comment or board approval. Do we know the process there?
Tom, this is Michele. I'm not 100% sure how to answer that. I think, James has his hand up. James, go ahead.
Yeah, same, Michele. I don't have an answer, but I think that's a question best directed towards our liaison's office to understand specifically what the process is for submitting this for approval, if that's even required, and if there is some sort of format that had to be followed in submitting this.
Okay.
I'm thinking specifically of like when the last constituency or stakeholder group was born. I know they had to go through a public comment and some other things like that. So I'm just wondering if any of that applies, or maybe since we're an existing constituency, we can just proceed without them.
James, this is Michele. I might ask. Marika, because I'd say she probably knows some of that stuff inside out, or Mike Zupke. Either one of those should be able to give us some guidance on that, so I'll take that away as an action point, if that's okay.
Okay. So let's go into the document, and I'll just start with the overview section first and see if anyone has any comments on those three points of bullets that I have there about what we're trying to achieve here, if they want to add in some other comments. Okay. I'll take that as no comments right now. If you do have something, feel free to send it to the list offline. I'd like to move down to amendment number one. If we just skip past my summary commentary and go right to amendment number one. I'm sorry, the first change, which are the the addition of definitions for the bylaws. This is on page 3 of the document. And so these definitions are straight from the RAA 2013 agreement that ICANN has published, and they define affiliate, affiliated registrar, applicable registrar family, and control. Are there any comments or questions or suggestions about adding these definitions to the bylaws?
Tom, this is Michele. I'll let James go just very quickly. But just one point of clarification. These, we don't actually, we define further what we mean by control in terms of percentages and things like that further on, don't we?
I don't think we have a percentage anywhere else.
Okay. James, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. And I don't mean to overcomplicate this. I think that it's good to align the definitions used in our bylaws with those in the RAA. My only question or concern is that if there have been material changes between the 2009 RAA and the 2013 RAA in those definitions, that we're going to have a mixed environment for a few years, perhaps, where registrars' members are on both agreements. So I would just want to have some clarification on if the definition that's in the bylaws and the definition that's in the RAA that applies to a particular member is in conflict, we're very clear that we are using the 2013 definitions, even if the registrar is on the 2009 RAA. And if that's my understanding, I think maybe just explicitly state that. That's all. Thanks.
So James, this is Tom again. I wasn't actually proposing that we would explicitly say that this came from the 2013 RAA. So it's simply definitions that we copied from another document for the purpose of our bylaws. And we're not necessarily trying to keep them in sync with the RAA or saying if they're in agreement with other documents. So the question is, can we have a definition within our bylaws that might diverge over time from what's in the RAA?
Well, this is James speaking again. This is only an issue if there are material or substantive differences between the definitions. If we all just agree that the definition that's in the bylaws is the one that we're going to use to manage the stakeholder group, I'm fine with that. If we're trying to align them, then we should try to align them as consistently as possible.
Okay. This is
Michele. Just one question, just to James and to Tom. Is there a substantial difference between the definitions? I mean, personally, I don't really mind. I mean, as obviously, if our bylaws state that X is, that this, the sky is blue, we're fine, as long as we're following that. But I mean, is there much of a difference, James, or is this more of a kind of an academic hypothetical question?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a difference. It seems like we're trying to impose some consistency, which I think is a good thing. I just want to make sure that we're consistently consistent. So if it's academic, then I'll drop it. But I'm trying to avoid confusion, as I'm sure we all are. Thanks.
Yeah. So this is Tom. Just to be clear, this language is verbatim from the 2013 RAA. So there's no difference between this language and the 2013 RAA. James's point is that there may be a difference between the 2009 RAA and the 2013 RAA, which means that registrars are, I guess, being held to different standards if they stand to the 2009 RAA compared to the stakeholder group bylaws.
I think, for the stakeholder group to say we are operating under the 2013 definitions, even if you don't, even if you haven't signed that agreement yet, and it's perfectly acceptable for a stakeholder group, I think, to say that. Anyway, I'll just drop it. I didn't mean to take us down a rabbit hole here. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't, for the best of intentions of solving a problem, creating bigger ones. So it doesn't sound like we are. Thanks.
Volker?
Yes, I actually wanted to raise a similar point as James, that we just need to ensure that we have a footnote somewhere that we are referencing the most current version of the RAA, whatever that might be. That would solve that problem, I think. Everybody would be under the same rules, and we would be most current with our RAA definition as well.
There may still be
another RAA after the 2013, although I pray that they won't.
Yeah, this is Tom. I assume that the bylaws don't change simply because the RAA changes. So the bylaws would only change if someone made a motion to make that change and it was voted in by the members. So we don't necessarily keep track with changes for the RAA automatically. So is there a suggestion to add language in here saying that we want these definitions to automatically change if the RAA changes?
Tom, this is Michele. I don't think that's what was being suggested. I think we may have gone down a slight bit of a rabbit hole by accident. I think it was just clarification as to where the terms came from. And unless I hear otherwise, I think everybody's happy with the definitions and where they came from, so I think we can just move on.
Okay. I'm going to ask specifically the last paragraph in these bylaw definitions talks about any disputes regarding these definitions would be resolved by unanimous decision of the executive committee, and absent a unanimous decision would be resolved by a majority vote of the membership. I wonder if we should add the fact that if there is a unanimous decision of the XCOM, that should be communicated to the membership, you know, within a certain time period, and so that the membership would be aware that a decision had been made.
Thomas McKaylee, that seems reasonable. And for the avoidance of doubt, I mean, I don't know if you want to set a time frame for that. That's fine by me. It makes perfect sense to me anyway that it would be communicated.
Okay. All right. We'll go to the next motion, which is called Amendment 1, Terms of Office, which talks about Section 3.3.4, limits on officers from the same member. And this basically prohibits a member from being represented more than once on the executive committee or both simultaneously or consecutively. And, in fact, the word either probably should be added in front of the word simultaneously here. This does not prohibit anyone from moving from the XCOM to what we call a ICANN committee positions such as NOMCOM or GNSO. Any comments on this? James?
Hi, Tom. A quick question here, and whether this is a friendly or unfriendly, I'm not sure, but I'm really struggling with what we're trying to guard against with the concept of consecutively. I mean, certainly no one can hold two offices simultaneously. I think that's just common sense. But we've had a number of cases in the past where stakeholder group chairs, including our current chair, our previous chair, and other chairs, and other officers in the XCOM have been nominated for different positions on the XCOM and have run, and others have come on board, in those positions that were vacated there. I guess, are we trying to just keep us out of continuous election mode? Is that what we're gunning for here? Or do we feel like this is an actual potential for problem area? I don't quite get what we're going at with consecutively. Thanks. I don't know that I'm proposing any kind of a friendly or unfriendly amendment. I'm trying to understand what our intent is.
And just to back that up, it's Michele speaking. I have the same question because if these were our current bylaws, I couldn't be in the position I'm in now, which mightn't be bad.
I think our last two chairs were already on the XCOM and were. Yeah, so I think that's what we're trying to understand.
Yeah,
I think this is just one of the themes that came out of the survey about trying to get greater participation of different members on the XCOM. I'm interested in if people have other opinions on this or if they think this is completely unnecessary.
Tom, this is Michele. I mean, I think I can understand that people, the idea of greater participation, all that, I get that. But I'm also very conscious of the fact that it's not like we're able to grow participants in test tubes and kind of magically create them overnight. I mean, for somebody to volunteer to serve on the XCOM is a serious commitment of time and everything else. And also as well, I mean, speaking for myself, I wouldn't have felt comfortable going into the XCOM as chair. That would have scared the living bejesus out of me. I mean, having served a few months as secretary gave me an idea and understanding of how things worked. And I suspect that other, chairs and other people who have held positions on the XCOM may feel similarly. I don't know. I can't speak for them. But just speaking for myself, I just do have concerns with this consecutively thing. I can see it is causing us potentially more harm than good. Personally, I have a problem with that.
I agree with that. I think if we had a pool that we could choose from every time and had runoff elections every time, then this would make absolute sense. But so far, from my experience, the pool of volunteers has always been rather small. We always had one person election just once or twice in the recent times we had runoffs. So I'm not sure if it really is a necessity to have this at this point in the bylaws, because by including this, we will be reducing the number of volunteers that are capable of performing a role in our XCOM and may run into a situation where nobody volunteers for an open position, which is something that would be very bad for us.
Well, at the end, I guess, since we all have just one voice and one vote, if the membership doesn't want someone to come into another office, they can not elect them. So I don't see why we should preclude them per se.
And just for the record, I mean, I'm just looking at the chat on there. Pretty much everybody who's made any comment on that would be supportive of the concerns that both myself and James have raised, and Tom has raised, and Volker has raised.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just speaking for me, I think that consecutively thing is going to cause us more headaches than anything else. So I would politely suggest that the term consecutively be struck.
Okay. I appreciate those comments. I guess my thinking was, first of all, we've seen a lot of people put in years of long volunteer work, and then I think they get burnt and they don't come back and turn in leadership positions. Whereas if they could come in and out, that might encourage people to come back and serve an office a leadership position again. So That's one thought. The other thought was, I know we have a lot of elections with one person. To me, that doesn't indicate a lack of bench. It means that once we find one people, we're pretty much happy with the fact that someone volunteered. And I suspect that we haven't had to go an election without anyone running, which implies there's always someone willing to volunteer. But I'm not completely passionate about that this particular issue. I thought it was just a good idea to try out. Any other comments on number one? All right, number two. I'm sorry, it's also as part of number one is section 3.3.5, which is a fairly new amendment that says that, again, the same concept that no more than one member can serve simultaneously or consecutively on the NOMCOM or GNSO. So are the same concerns exist for this one as well in terms of the word consecutively?
Yeah. Tom, this is McKaylee. I would say that yes, I would have concerns with the term consecutively. For the same reasons as in the previous clause.
So this basically says we're okay with people moving from the GNSO to NOMCOM and vice versa.
This is Tom. Yeah, I think it's the same thing, actually. I totally agree with Michaela on that. So I don't see why someone shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
If we elect them to do so.
I mean, the thing is, ultimately, sorry, it's Michaela speaking. Ultimately, if we think somebody is not a suitable person or is not suitable for a role, it's up to us in the membership to not re-elect them or to not elect them. Now, if we all just sit back on our laurels and just vote for people simply for the sake of it, then, you know, we reap what we sow.
Just one comment, which is in support of Tom. I mean, the current makeup of the stakeholder group is not necessarily the one that is going to be the makeup of the stakeholder group in 10 years, with possible new registrars coming up. And having voting rights could be a case of one stakeholder group dominating us. So it might be the interesting opportunity to have this the term limit in there. But on the other hand, if there are a lot of registrars that are able to outvote the current registrars, they probably will also have a lot of candidates, so this will not help the end.
Hey, this is James. I just wanted to agree as well. It's not like we're turning people away at the door. I did have a question. Are we into the meat and potatoes now, number two, Tom, or should I hold that question? Regarding that expanded definition?
Well, we're still on the one labeled number one, 3.3.5.
Yeah, okay. I'll hold then, thanks.
All right, so let's move on to number two, which is section 4.3.6, potential conflicts with another stakeholder group. So there's a lot in here. It's trying to first make sure that a member is only voting in one stakeholder group and does not do hopping from one stakeholder group to another to try to get their vote in. So it has a 12-month window in which they could not have voted in another group. But we also want to know if they're associated with entity that has signed an ICANN contract where they have specifically asked for exemption from the code of conduct. They would be exempting from holding office. And then, in addition, if they are a single registrant or zero registrant registrar, they would be exempt to hold office. Comments on this one? I know this impacts some of our current members, especially that last one.
Yeah, actually, it's Tom speaking. I'm interested in that. So are we talking about, like, a person, or do we talk a member? So if we would have a subsidiary or a company that's in some way connected to my company that actually runs a registry, we wouldn't be able to actually participate and vote or have...
So we're talking about legal entities here, not individuals. So it's someone representing a member of the stakeholder group, member being a legal entity. And we realize that registrars will be associated with registries. The issue is whether or not that associated registry has received an exemption from ICANN for the code of conduct, which has several attributes to it, but one of which is to treat all registrars equally.
So this is James, with two comments or questions. First one is, rather than reference the code of conduct in our bylaws, which could change, perhaps we should actually spell out that criteria on Spec 9, which I think specifically discusses whether or not registrations are made available to unaffiliated third parties. And there's some other things in there, of course, as well, but I think that that's the one we're looking for, right, for the vertically integrated or brand organizations. And then my second question or comment or something I just want to throw out to the group is, and maybe a little draconian, but an idea of if we are prohibiting a certain class of members from holding office, should they not also be prohibited from voting? And if so, does that essentially create a de facto observer class of membership? And should we, maybe that was what we should be aiming for, as opposed to what we have here? And I'm not advocating for that. I'm just putting that out there as another possibility, because I think I agree with the rationale that we are attempting to avoid an influx of certain types of non-registrant or single registrant entities that could, swamp the stakeholder group. So those are just my comments or questions, and I'll be happy to withdraw them if they go over like a lead balloon.
James, this is Tom. I like the idea of referencing the specific language in the code of conduct, so I can make that change. We do also have the same language in terms of voting rights as well, so the question is, I guess your question is, should we go and actually simply define another type of membership? As you call an observer member that has less, that has reduced rights, should it be explicit in doing that, or is it fine the way it is?
And I think the question I'm posing to the group is, does this go far enough, or do we want to add voting as well?
This is Michele speaking. Just reading this entire thing, I think I understand the concept behind it, and I don't have any issues with the concept. I mean, I think in simple terms, what we don't want is a situation where, let's say, for argument's sake, that I'm somehow managed to get our company to be a member of the ISP constituency, or stakeholder group, whatever the hell they're called, was voting both in the ISPs and with the registrars, because That's double dipping, which shouldn't be allowed. I don't have any issue with the idea of us having non-voting members. At the moment, we have a kind of an informal thing where we have several non-voting members because those entities, they happen to own a registrar, but their main focus is on registry operations. So, for example, I think Minds and Machines is one, Google is another, and Oz Registry is another one that I'm aware of that aren't voting in our stakeholder group because they want to vote in the other ones. And as John Berryville pointed out, other SGs have similar restrictions. So the organization has to choose where they assign their vote. Union Registry, for example, has joined the registry stakeholder group as a non-voting member to preserve iRegistry's vote in the registrar stakeholder group. So, I mean, they could have done it the other ways. The other comment I'd make is that maybe somebody who is good at deciphering legal English could actually have a look at the wording of that clause, because I read it 4 or 5 times and I was having terrible difficulty wrapping my brain around what it was actually saying, because there's so many commas and subclauses in it. So maybe if somebody could have a look at maybe just rejigging the wording a little bit. There's enough lawyers within the stakeholder group, God almighty, somebody must be able to make it a little bit more accessible. Thanks.
This is James again. Based on McKelly's statement and John's comment in the chat, I'll withdraw the comment. I think that voting restrictions that are laid out are probably sufficient when used in conjunction with the office holding stuff. So, thank you.
So this is Tom. Are there any other comments about 4.3.6 in terms of whether or not we're going enough or going too far?
Volker has his hand raised. Volker.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is something that we've been discussing in the working group for the bylaws for a long time. This is kind of a puzzler, because once you go down that rabbit hole, where do you draw the line? We've been discussing ideas of where the majority of the business lies, or of a certain entity, and that's the place they should vote. We've been discussing what we have here, the simple who does not vote in any other stakeholder group or constituency. And we've been discussing ideas where an entity that is represented in another stakeholder group, and that, for example, if you're a brand registrar and are a member of INTA and INTA votes in the IP constituency, should you be barred from the voting in the registrar's constituency because you are kind of represented in the IP constituency as well. But we've decided against that in the end, because that's very difficult decision to make. You cannot, as an outsider, judge business value of are there more a registry or a registrar, and memberships and other entities that are voting members in another one. That's also very hard to determine. And frankly, it's a very deep rabbit hole that's going into this. Is the minimal consensus that we've been able to reach, the minimal requirement voting in another stakeholder group, and I think it can be expanded upon, yes, but the more we expand it, the more complicated it gets.
Volker, just because I'm thick, Michele speaking, so what are you saying, that that you don't have an issue with restricting voting, but you have an issue with something else? Is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't speak to that exactly. I just think that restricting voting and restricting holding office should be the same thing.
So it'd be the same thing.
How far you go, where you restrict those votes, that's a very difficult decision to make. And the proposal that we have now, restricting it to entities that have not voted in the past 6 months and do not vote, or 12 months and do not vote in another constituency or stakeholder group, I think is the best and easiest to implement a solution. There's probably more that can be done, more restrictions that can be drawn, but then it goes very into a very complicated area, which I'm not sure we want to go down.
This is Tom again.
This is Tom. Any comments?
The question I have is, while we actually want to restrict people from voting for something, they have a wild business interest in. I think we should make sure that it's not the same person, and we should make sure that two people from the same company or family, however you want to call it, should not be officers of two different kind of constituencies or represent them in any shape or form. But, I mean, there will be registries out there that have very large registrars, and I think they have a very vested interest in actually voting on both things and maybe even in opposition, depending on what the thing is about. And if you have a look at a lot of the company structures and how they're set up, I think, you know, banning someone who's already voting, participating in another constituency from our constituency is not really reflecting the reality. So I don't get the voting thing as long as the number of people don't outweigh the, say, regular registrars. So I don't see the issue why we should restrict the voting. I understand the holding office part. So.
Volker, your hand up?
Yeah, I would like to answer to that. The voting and the holding office are not that different. When we're looking at a situation where the makeup of the stakeholder group may change and members of other stakeholder groups suddenly become registrars as well, there may be an interest to gain more influence in ICANN by gaining more influence in this in the contracted parties house, and the registries have pretty much closed their doors to new players by their voting rules, whereas we have not changed our bylaws yet. So anyone who can set up a registrar, which is I think doable under $10,000, can have a vote, or currently can have a vote and can be elected in the registrar stakeholder group, even though a member of their company is also representing their company in another stakeholder group, for example, the IP constituency or the BC. This is problematic because ICANN functions by having different interest groups coming together and putting their heads together and coming to a compromise solution. If you now have an interest group that is represented on two sides of the houses, has an influence in a strong influence in two stakeholder groups, then that equilibrium gets skewed, and you suddenly have a situation where the registrars could no longer represent the registrars, but would be another representative, for example, of the IPC or BC. That's the situation that we want to avoid by having them excluded from voting and holding office.
Anyone else? Yeah, just to add to Volker's comment, this is Tom Barrett. I definitely think that the makeup of registrars are going to change. We're going to see a lot of vertically integrated registries in the coming rounds, and all of those folks will have their own registrars and obviously a different set of interests. So our goal is to try to focus on registrars who are focused on retail-type customers and not get swamped by other types of registrars. There's no more comments on number two. I'll move to number three, which is 4.3.7, which talks about mandated resignation of the officer, non-com, or GNSO representative. And this deals with an elected member who, during the term of office, becomes ineligible to serve in office because of the prior restrictions we've been talking about. And this section basically says that they should resign immediately, and the stakeholder group would hold another election. The member resigning can certainly stand for election again, but the members are given a chance to decide if he should stay in office. Any comments on this?
Right. Michaeli, just one question. This, you're looking at 4.3.7, yeah?
Correct.
I'm a little bit confused by one part of this. If you're no longer associated with a member, so let's just say hypothetically, I sold Black Knives and went off to work for, Disney. So I have absolutely nothing to do with any registrar business. So you're saying here that even though I should resign, I can still run for election again. I'm a bit confused by that part, the second part.
Right. Well, obviously, I didn't. There are some folks who we may decide we want to continue in office, even though they're no longer associated with the member.
Okay. I'm a bit confused by that. Volker has his hand up. Go ahead, Volker.
Yeah, I've raised that on the list already, but by having the person step down and then holding the election, we are creating a potential vacuum which may not be beneficial to our interests. For example, if the situation that Michaela just described would turn up tomorrow, then we'd be there without a chair for 30 days. While we have a vice chair that could fill in, it still might be better to have a solution in place that would not create that vacuum. It would be the same for GNSO seats, where we would suddenly lose one vote for 30 days. So what I suggested, and I would still suggest that we do, is that we have the representative offer his resignation and have an election whether that resignation would be accepted, and then him stepping down only at the end of the new election. Thank you.
So in other words, not having a vacuum is what you mean.
Exactly. So you have him offer the resignation, but the resignation will not become effective until a new person has been elected. I think that would solve the problem.
I tend to agree. I'm still a bit confused about the idea of the person running for election again if they're no longer associated with a member, though. That does throw me. I mean, was that just because you didn't want the vacuum, or what's the rationale behind that?
This is Tom again. I was actually thinking of a case. We've had officers in the past. I'll pick on Mason, for example, who basically has been working at Donuts for the past year. But we've basically agreed that he should stay on the XCOM or GNSO.
But he was elected to the position while he was associated with a member.
Correct. So the question is, since he stopped being associated with a member, should the membership should have a chance to decide if he should continue to represent the SG, and the membership was not given that opportunity.
Okay. So. Basically, right. So, in my understanding of this, if the person tenders their resignation or offers to make their resignation, then that deals with it. It's just that what was confusing me is the idea that they would run for election again, even though they're no longer associated with a member, which didn't seem logical to me. I mean, the idea that they tender the resignation, the membership could say, "Well, actually, we're happy to let you, stay on for the rest of the term, or, you know, or thanks for the resignation, yeah, let's, we'll run an election now. Seems a bit more logical to me. There's other people in the queue, so I'll see to Volker and James.
Let me just respond to that real quick. I think the intent was to try to address the vacuum problem that Volker is getting at, and his approach is probably better than what I'm proposing here. So I'm happy to change the language so that the person stays in office until a replacement is found. We may still want to give the membership the opportunity to decide that person stays representing the stakeholder group, even though they no longer work within the industry.
Volker and James?
I agree that somebody who has left the industry or has taken up another role in the industry should probably offer his resignation, and I also agree that he shouldn't be reelected. But as for vacating the seat immediately, that might cause a problem, and I think that would be easily solved by my suggested amendment.
Any other comments on 4.3.7?
This was James. I was in the queue. I keep dropping out. I tend to agree with Volker. I just wanted to add, I think we're looking at potentially, or we perhaps need to consider two different scenarios. One is the scenario in which an individual who is an office holder is no longer eligible to be a member of the stakeholder group. That is, if they've left the industry and went to work for Disney. And then the second one would be that they're still eligible to be a member, but the change of their membership is that they're no longer eligible to be an office holder. So, for example, if McKelly, instead of selling Black Knight, became more of a single entity registrant or a single registrant entity that we were discussing earlier. I just wanted to point out that I think it's noble that we would want to avoid any vacancies, especially prolonged vacancies. But I think that perhaps we might want to treat those two scenarios differently, because in the case where someone is now representing an ineligible organization, I think that that we might want to consider the immediate vacancy as the lesser of two evils. And I don't mean to say anything's evil. I mean just that that might be something we would treat differently.
Any other comments on this? All right, next section, section number 4.5.1.3. It's just some revised wording on an existing clause. Any comments on this? The existing language, as far as I know, does not prohibit multiple members from voting, even if one has acquired the other. So we kind of close that loophole. All right, number 5, section 4.5.2, eligibility for voting. It has the same language that we saw earlier in terms of eligibility for holding office. I assume all the same comments there would apply here as well. Anyone have additional comments they want to make?
This is Mike from ComLaude. Just looking at the rationale language, you said prohibits voting for members who function mainly for closed registries. And then further at the top, you have the we've got or serves as a single registrant or zero registrant registrar. So what's the definition of catering for mainly closed registries? Or are you just looking to try and prohibit this for somebody who is a registrar just for themselves, essentially?
So, Mike, this is Tom. The rationale, first of all, would not be included in the bylaws. I thought that was more my commentary. I don't think that's actually part of the bylaws, but I was trying to explain what we thought we were trying to prohibit by people getting an exemption from Spec 9 of the Code of Conduct. Per the earlier suggestion, we're going to replace that language with the specific area that talks about the equal treatment of all registrars. So that's really what that comment is aimed at. Did that answer your question?
That answers that question. I think as we progress down the new GTLD route, there's going to be a lot more vertical integration, and it's going to be a lot. It's going to be likely that somebody who is a registry operator becomes a registrar. Some of those may be a closed registrar, a single registrant registrar, and it is in their interest to vote in two different sides. So the registry operator should have a voting member on the registry side, and likewise, in some instances, there should be a vote also on the registrar side. And then you have other companies where an affiliate could be a consultant, so in our case, for example. And on the consultancy side, it may be that we have a vote in the interest of our clients on that side, and also in the interests of us as a registrar on this side.
Right. So I believe the registry bylaws today would prohibit you from doing that already. If you vote, so for that vertically integrated registry, if they would not be able to vote in both stakeholder groups today based on the registry bylaws. And we're basically adding the same language into our bylaws as well.
But there may be other groups that are not the registry.
Yep. The basic idea is, like I said before, to discourage double dipping, which can be a problem.
Yep.
If some interest groups suddenly have an influence in two stakeholder groups, no matter if it's justified by their business setup or not, might in the end break the ICANN model because it no longer creates such an incentive to come to compromise if they can just co-opt another stakeholder group and force them to represent their interests as well. That's something that we have to be very, very careful to prevent. In that case, we had that in our coming up in our discussions as well, and the solution was, frankly, to choose which one is the majority of your business and go with that stakeholder group.
And this is Tom again. I mean, and they might not even choose which is the majority of their business. That's not a requirement for them. So they might just choose which ones where they think their influence would be most effective or needed, as opposed to where the majority of their business is. So there are no requirements that they have to vote with a majority of their businesses at this point. And John Berryhill asked the question, do we have a definition of a single registrar? We do not have a definition, John. Like many of the other aspects of this, it's on the honor system, and I guess if someone feels like someone's abusing the bylaws, then they can ask for a vote to decide if that abuse is taking place. Or do you want to propose
another point that I wasn't... Sorry, Tom.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tom. I didn't want to cut in. That's another point I was a bit concerned about, because I can see a lot of scenarios where... it might not be a single registrant registrar, but a dual registrant registrar or a triple registrant registrar. So by quoting the single registrant registrar, then we are allowing, by the choice of words that we have, the registrars that only serve a handful of customers or a dozen of customers. And actually, that's just the same problem with those that we have with the single registrant registrar. For example, if you have a registry operator that has a .brand TLD, sets up a registrar for their group of companies instead of the own company, and the group of company uses that TLD exclusively, and they want to set up as a registrar because that's where they want to have their foothold in ICANN, even though they're mostly a brand owner and would belong in the IPC. But in that case, I also would like to restrict their voting, not because I don't feel they belong into the group, but I think just that the single registrant registrar is too narrow for what we're trying to accomplish here.
Okay. So this is Tom again. James is suggesting something in the chat. Do you want to talk, James?
And I think what we're trying to do, to echo some of what Volker is saying, is to ensure that we don't skew influence towards new TLDs that represent brand interests at the expense of a definition that inadvertently catches up aftermarket or portfolio registrars. And I think one of the thoughts, and this would really overcomplicate this, and I apologize for in advance for making it more complicated than it needs to be, but the idea that registrars would declare their business model as a retail, wholesale, corporate, aftermarket, or brand, and that we would essentially just say, okay, and this category, brand, is not eligible to hold office or something like that. So, that might be one way to do it, but then it starts to mimic the GNSO on a smaller level within the stakeholder group. But I think to John's point, and I don't want to presume too much about where he's going with this, is that the definition is lacking in that it's if it's done too broadly per the stakeholder group, it sweeps up existing portfolio registrars when the intention is to address the interests of brand registry registrars, vertically integrated registry registrars.
This is Tom, and I guess there's another scenario which I had in mind here, which is I think that there will be many dot brand registries that will not seek an exemption from the code of conduct to be vertically integrated, which means that on the surface they treat all registrars equally, but in fact they'll only give business to one registrar, and in fact they'll become a single registrar. That the registrar they use, which could be totally unassociated or unaffiliated with them, would become for them a single registrar for their TLD. So there's that, and I think in fact that might be a more common scenario that we're going to see, as opposed to dot brands trying to get exemption from the code of conduct. Any other comments on this? Okay.
No, I agree. That's something that we are seeing already.
Yeah. All right, number six talks about staggering the elections of the XCOM so that we have, if there are four members of the XCOM as they are today, we have only two running at a time, and then 6 months later we have the other two run for office. Any comments on this? Does anyone like the idea? Does it is it worth the trouble of running staggered elections, or is it unnecessary?
James here. I think that given the learning curve associated with that and with other positions, I think it's a good thing to make sure that we're not. I think it's a good thing to have staggered elections so that we're not replacing too many offices at one time, and that there's some continuity between, and I'm using air quotes over here, between, you know, administrations or groups of officers. I would point out, however, that due to the frequency of turnover in these offices and the fact that it sounds like, are arriving at an idea that we would not prohibit consecutive use, that it seems like we're almost in continuous election mode, and that this may be unnecessary, but I think that it's a good, the intention is sound.
This is Michele. Just kind of following up on what James is saying, I mean, what we've seen consistently over the last few years is that as, you know, people move between positions and rotations and God knows what else. So while I don't have an issue with the staggering, I think that's a good idea. But I would be wary of 4.8.2, where specifying specifically which positions the elections are for. For the simple reason that what keeps on happening is that we end up with people moving. So, for example, James's term as treasurer, I'm not too sure when that would have been up because I haven't been keeping track, but, you know, he's leaving that position to go because he's been elected to the GNSO Council. And that kind of thing has happened several times in the past. When Volker got elected to the GNSO Council, he was secretary. I think, you know, idea that there'd be two elections per year is fine, but I would be wary of specifying for exactly which posts.
So, Michele, this is Tom. How would you, if we don't specify the post, how do we transition into this amendment?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, what I'd be afraid of is making it a bit too restrictive in the wording. So I understand the spirit of it. I have no issue with the spirit of it whatsoever. I mean, I think maybe just there will be two elections held each year, depending on the, I'm not sure the exact wording. If somebody help me out. I think it's just down to the election, to the terms that people end up with, because otherwise we end up with this kind of continuous election. You might end up ending up with elections when you don't really need elections, but you should have a minimum of two elections per year. I don't know if see as a problem. Volker has his hand up.
Yeah, I've raised my issues with this already. Generally, I also think that the idea behind it is sound. However, it creates a certain number of problems. If you add the specification, then these problems are compounded. Basically, my issue with this is that you end up in a situation where it's going to be more difficult for people to switch between posts. For example, in the example that we have here, a vice chair moving up to chair, or anything similar to that. And I'm not sure if that's something that we really want. By staggering these elections, we make such changes in our for our officers a lot harder, and the way that we've worked in the past, where we've groomed our stakeholders or our officers for higher office by letting them start, for example, in one office and then move up to another office. By the way, congratulations, James. That's something I think that's very valuable to us, and I'm not sure if that's something that we really want to lose by staggering the elections and having basically half a year of free time before you can move up from, for example, secretary to vice chair or chair, whatever.
Hi, this is Tom. Volker, I think that's a fair point. Of course, we're not preventing anyone from running for another office, even if they still have time left on their term, but I guess that's the way it would do that, or they take 6 months off. But I think what your point's a good point. So we have a suggestion of perhaps removing the mention of what positions are paired together and leaving that to be resolved later. And then the question about whether or not this is even a worthwhile thing, given that you want to encourage people apparently to switch from one position to the other, and this makes it more difficult to do that. Any other comments on this? Number 7 talks about staggered nominations. The idea here is that we encourage diversity among the officers from different geographic regions. And so this was originally part of the previous amendment, but it's now designed to be standalone. So 4.8.3 really is a moot issue at this point. It almost doesn't matter. But the real meat of it is 4.8.4, where nominations are first called from candidates who are not represented by the existing members of the XCOM. And so whether this be an election for 2 members or 4 members, the same rule would apply. It'd be a nomination of candidates from ICANN regions not represented in the last 2 election cycles. And then after that nomination round is completed, even if people are nominated, we will still ask for another round of nominations that'll be open from any geographic region. So the concern there was that we don't want to necessarily enforce or require diversity if, in fact, the candidates are not the ideal candidates for different positions. But this is a way to ensure that the underrepresented regions at least get to nominate someone to run for the office. Any comments about this amendment about staggered nominations, which, again, is totally standalone from staggered elections? Volker?
Yes, just one minor comment here, which has to do with the staggered elections as well. Basically, my comment would be that if you stagger the elections, you're reducing your pool of potential candidates even further, because essentially you're only opening a certain seat up to a certain region. And I'm not sure if that's something that we want. For example, if you had an Asian representative on a certain seat, and it would make sense to have the only geographical nomination that would apply here would be have another Asian person in there, we would restrict that. I think having all the elections at the same time makes it a lot easier for us to stagger to elect people of different geographic backgrounds as well. So yes, I actually agree with the idea of having geographic denominations for the different offices. However, I think this is also in conflict with the staggered election. So one or not, but not the other would be my suggestion for that.
Yeah, okay. Any other comments on this?
Michaela here. I like the idea, but I can understand why Volker has a couple of potential issues with us. But I do like the idea. I think geographic diversity is something that we should try to accommodate wherever possible, or maybe accommodate isn't the word. We should try to, I don't know, facilitate, push, encourage, whatever word you're more comfortable with. So, I mean, personally, I like the idea. Again, the devil's in the details, I suppose, but, you know, I'm supportive of it.
Mike, do you have your hand up? Okay. All right, if there's no other questions, we'll go to number 8, voting by GNSO counselors. And this is just, a simple amendment by Tim to point out that elected GNSO counselors must vote as directed by the executive committee of the stakeholder group if such direction is provided. Any issues or questions, comments on number 8?
This is Michele speaking. I think this is actually a good suggestion, because I think this is one of those things that it's kind of like a gentleman's understanding that this is what we were doing anyway, so that, you know, that as far as a lot of us would have been concerned, our GNSO councillors were meant to act in the interests of the stakeholder group via the XCOM. But I think putting this into an actual proper form, into a proper, you know, terms, whatever, formalizing that is a good idea, so I'm supportive of it.
All right, number 9, should we still hold elections even if there's only one candidate for the position? So currently the bylaws say that we do hold the election, and the candidate needs to receive at least 50% of the votes cast to win that election. The proposal is to say no election would be held at all. So it's either a yes or no to making the change. Any comments on this?
James, go ahead.
Yes, James speaking. And I'm thinking that, you know, there probably is a way to, since we all admit that our election process is very lengthy and involved, and I'm sure Jennifer has some pleasant words to describe our Big Pulse system, and as well as Michele and Volker. And then we also acknowledge that almost all of our elections are single candidates. So, you know, I think that the ability to abstain does give does provide the ability to, you know, essentially cast a vote of no confidence against a particular candidate. But I think that we should consider the idea of expediting it somehow. Now, maybe that is still holding an election, but compressing the time scale or eliminating the 30-day discussion period, or, well, that's for the budget, but other, you know, sorts of discussion periods or something along those lines. Or perhaps even moving towards a consent agenda model like we see with the council and other organizations, where we essentially say, you know, is anyone opposed to this particular candidate? If so, please indicate, you know, so. And then if you receive a certain threshold of opposition votes, then you would move to an election. Something along those lines, I think, would be valuable, because, as others have noted, we seem to be in continuous election mode for a lot of single-candidate races. Thanks.
This is Michele. Just supporting James, I think, you know, in the discussions on the members list around this particular clause, several people put forward some very strong and, you know, well-worded arguments why having a vote of some kind, even if there's only one candidate, is important for, you know, to allow them to abstain and basically block somebody from being elected, or to vote no, as it were. But I think the main reason why we were getting frustrated with the current situation is because the process is so protracted. So, as James was suggesting, if there was some way of having an accelerated election where you only have one candidate to allow people that option, then I personally would like that idea. Maybe that might help address people's concerns.
Hi, this is Tom. There is something in the bylaws about a fast track motion. Maybe we could use a similar method for fast track elections.
Hey Tom, if it works, I mean, I think that's what James is is talking about, and I'm sure there are other people who've kind of gone, oh, for God's sake, you know, we have to go through this entire process. We're all happy that person X has stepped up to the plate, but we, you know, that's fine. And John has put on the chat there, one could imagine a scenario in which the fact of a membership in the SG is imputed as approval. Sorry, what? And which member would like to be able to say they did not affirmatively vote for that officer? Okay, so they just allowing members the ability to basically state that they did not support that person's election, even if the person still gets elected. I think there's, you know, there's valid reasons why people might want to do that, but if we could accelerate the process, that would help.
Yeah, and this is James. Just to be clear, I wasn't calling or agreeing with the idea that there shouldn't be elections. I'm just looking for ways to expedite the election process when there's only one candidate. But I think that that would still provide the opportunity for someone to vote no or abstain, which I think would address John's point.
Okay, moving on to number 10. Should members be allowed to formally abstain in a vote? The bylaws are silent on this. So the assumption has always been that members are allowed to abstain. So this is simply a way to formalize that in the bylaws. Any questions or comments on this one?
This is McKaylee. I think I should have the right to abstain on a vote if I want to. So I don't see why we shouldn't have that. I mean, I'm trying to understand why there'd be a problem with the concept of people having the ability to abstain.
So James here, just to comment similarly, I think people, the right to abstain should be preserved in the bylaws, but I do think that if abstentions are counted as no votes or if abstentions are removed from the vote total, I think that should be made clear in the election so that those who are abstaining understand the impact of their abstention.
Thanks. Just following up actually on James' comment, I mean, in terms of, from my perspective, an abstention is like a spoil vote. You're exercising your right to vote without choosing a candidate, so it should count towards the number of votes cast. This thing about whether an abstention equals no or not, I'm not sure that it does mean no. I'm not too sure what it means because I think it depends on the context. I mean, I can think of contexts in which people might want to abstain due to potential conflicts of interest. As John says, abstention ordinarily counts towards satisfying a quorum requirement. In other words, it counts towards the number of votes cast if that is required. But
right.
I'd be very wary of stating that an abstention equals no or yes or anything like that.
No, McKaylee, I'm sorry. I have to jump back in here because if the threshold for voting is, let's say, 50% plus one, and someone abstains, then it has the practical effect of a no vote. I'm not saying that it does count as a no vote. I think that I just want to make
I'm not arguing about the practical or impractical. What I'm saying is, yeah, obviously, if they abstain, then they have the impact of it being a no vote. But it's not the same. But abstaining is not a way of voting no. We could argue about this one for hours. I'm not sure that abstention equals voting against a motion.
All right.
Yeah,
but,
I agree with that. I mean, regardless of whether you count the abstention either way, by voting abstain, the voter has at least done one thing, and that is help get the voting threshold that we need for a valid vote closer. So he has voted, therefore he has participated in the vote, therefore his vote counts as whatever. So the number of eligible voters that have to be voted is decreased by one. However that is counted, it's a different question.
All right. So this is Tom again. So I think this discussion is good, but I'm not seeing any changes to make to this proposed amendment. And likewise, we have 11, if members are allowed to abstain. So, I mean, basically, you vote yes or no if you want to be allowed to formally abstain in number 10. 11 is a similar question, whether or not it's voted as abstention voted as a vote against the proposed motion. And 12 talks about abstentions being part of the total count of votes cast. Any comments on 11 and 12? And then we have, I mean, just before we move on here, because I think that discussion was a good one. We don't always have the opportunity to have people give arguments for and against these amendments. Do you think we should add the for and against arguments in this amendment, or do you think they can stand on their own?
Volker, go ahead.
Oh, there's that vestigial hand again. Sorry. Taking it down.
All right. And then the last amendment, number 13, talks about vacation of office. And this is basically saying we don't want to create a vacuum. So if... if the person is able, if they're going to resign, they should stay in office until a replacement is elected to their new office. Any comments on that? And then the final part of this document actually has a list of members as of September 1. This was originally included because of we had a grandfathering clause in some of the amendments, which we have since taken out. So the list here is for information only. It's not really relevant to the bylaws itself.
Yep. Tom, this is James. Can I go back to number 13 for just a moment, please?
Yep.
So we're talking about vacating an office, notwithstanding reasons for leaving. An officer shall hold office until a successor is elected or until the officer dies, resigned, or is removed, disqualified, et cetera, et cetera. But yet, I want to make sure that we were not setting up the potential conflict that would be we don't want simultaneous office holders in a previous bylaw. We stated that. So I think, or until the officer, I'd like to add, or is elected to another office.
Okay.
Or am I missing the point here, or?
So I think Volker can chime in. I think the idea was, to avoid creating a vacuum. So.
Right, but if, for example, and I'm just going to speculate here using my own situation, okay, so just got elected to the council, but I don't take office until November. Suppose there that where it happened faster and I needed to be seated so that we would have a GNSO, full slate of GNSO representatives, but we had not yet settled the election for treasurer, we would just have to have a vacancy. Or would you, it seems like by reading this, the desire would be to for that person to hold both offices simultaneously, and I don't think we want that.
I would agree.
So I think added to your list here of dies, resigns, removed, et cetera, would be elected to another, elected to another registrar stakeholder group office.
All right.
I think in that rare scenario, we would not we would prefer the vacancy to a simultaneous office holder.
Okay. Any other comments on that?
Yep, agreed.
Any other comments on any other parts of these proposed amendments? All right, so what I'll do is I'll do another red line document and get that out to the membership, and we'll do another round of proposed changes to these.
Tom, I have a question for you, but mainly for the group. you've been working hard on this for a long time, and I think we're getting very close. But I also note that sometimes these things have a fractal nature to them, where we just keep getting half the distance to the goal. Would you anticipate that this next round is the last red line? It seems like we're running out of time as far as new members joining and things like that, and I think the things that we want to guard against by updating and refreshing our bylaws are, the day of reckoning is at hand, and I feel like we need to get moving on these things. So just my own personal opinion is, let's not run Tom's through the ringer much longer if we can call this our last iteration.
I mean, this is Tom. I think there's been a lot of good suggestions today. I'm taking nearly all these comments as friendly comments, and we'll be incorporating those in where I can. I don't think there'll be much disagreement, hopefully, after the next iteration.
This is McKaylee. Just as we're wrapping up, I've lost my voice. I just wanted to thank Tom and the others who have been working on this, and thanks to all of you who took this time this afternoon or evening or whatever time zone you're in to participate in this call. I think within the XCOM we have been talking about organizing more calls with members to try and keep you up to date on various activities that are going on. Just as one last thing, for most of you, you should have got information about the meeting in Berlin. And I know ICANN staff are currently working on the schedule for that meeting. If there are any issues you want raised during the meeting in Berlin, would you please email me directly, and I'll try to get them put on the schedule for that meeting. Are there any other issues anybody wants to raise at this time, or can we wrap this up? Okay.
Just to thank
everybody.
Just to extend the thanks to Tom and to the folks that are working on this.
Okay, thanks everybody.
Thanks, guys.